Aziz is an incredible brother with an incredible story, where he's come from and what he's doing now. I don't want to take anything away from him. I'll just say the first time we met was in Jerusalem as Aziz was just thinking about leaving Islam. And that was 11 years ago. And an incredible man of God. We even collaborated on the book, Jesus and Islam. And if you want it to be signed by both of us, see us later. Okay, Aziz, see that clock on the wall? You don't see it. That means something. Now, this is the last thing before the lunch break, and I'll come back around 5 to 12. This is our brother, Abdulaziz Abu Sarah. Thank you so much for being here, and I give you the microphone.
Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Oh, sorry. Wrong place. Did I scare anybody? You know, this is, it's great to be here. It's great to be with Doug and many friends and I forgot your name now. You know when you want to say somebody's name and it totally goes with Matt and staying with him and from Kuwait and all these missionaries and friends, and with Doug special, because Doug actually was in Jerusalem and I studied the Bible, and I got to ask him. I was studying and they having some hard time with me and with a million questions I was going through, and Doug was coming and they said, oh good, we have somebody we can throw you to and he can deal with you. So I'm grateful to that friendship that we developed since then. But also in Jerusalem, actually, when I preached, I normally actually would start with Arabic, then I switch to Hebrew, then I translate myself to English. And somewhere halfway through that, I preach a different sermon in each one of those languages. But it's amazing because we have a small church in Jerusalem. It goes anywhere between 10 to 20 people, depends how many people move in and out and all of that, but you get 10 people and you get sometimes 6 languages. And you preach in one, you translate yourself to one or two, depends on who's translating and who do you want to let translate your sermon. And then other people translating your translation. So as I'm translating my Arabic into English and my English into Hebrew, somebody's translating my Hebrew into Russian. And somebody's sometimes translating my Russian into Croatian. And it goes pretty far, which is a lot of fun, and that's what unity is all about. And that's, if anybody ever asks you about speaking in tongues, that's definitely, it does still happen. Let's open to Isaiah 11, which is where our title from. Isaiah 11 in verse 1. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From the roots, a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The Spirit of wisdom and of understanding. The Spirit of counsel and of power. The Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes or decide what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the goat. Now, occasionally I say some things wrong English, forgive me, as I'm reading. I make a lot of funny words I make up as sometimes I'm reading. So if I do that, just consider it part of the class. Tolerance. You know, this is a scripture talking about Jesus and talking about, it's a prophecy. And it goes through and it gets to the part where it talks about the wolf and the lion, and it talks about peace and talks about basically being able to be together. And this is great when you put it into perspective, really, with the Middle East. And when you put it to perspective with Israel and with Palestine, because we got a lot of conflict over there, and that's the way I grew up. I grew up seeing conflict all my life, since I was born. I grew up a Palestinian. I'm a Palestinian Muslim family, more or less a religious, traditional Muslim family that, I grew up religious. I went to an Islamic school growing up. Had to start fasting when I was 7 years old, start praying five times a day at the same time. Christians sometimes complain about quiet time once a day, you know. I have to wake up and pray, and well, try Islam for a week and see the difference. No, I'm not suggesting that. Okay. But five times a day, fasting a full month from sunrise to sunset, no water, no food. It's 7 years old, you start doing that. It's actually sometimes even before. But around me, there was a lot of conflict. Especially the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I grew up seeing people getting shot. I grew up seeing people hurt. I grew up seeing my neighbor when I was 8 years old, seeing him shot and dying and having to deal with that. But you know, to some level, as long as you far from it, you can distance yourself as long as it doesn't hit your home. And this is how it was for me. I thought, it's far from home, so I can distance myself a little bit. Unfortunately, this didn't last long for me. When I was 9 years old, a group of Israeli soldiers came into my home and broke in about 5 in the morning. It was Ramadan. We, you know, because of the fasting, what we did, we got up 5 in the morning, 4 in the morning, right before sunrise, and had a lot of food and water so we can get ready for the day of fasting. And you go to bed after. And after we went to bed, a group of soldiers came in, broke into our home, and decided to arrest my older brother, Taysir, who was 18 years old at that time. He was suspected of throwing stones at Israeli cars, and they wanted him for interrogation. He was taken for a few days first for the interrogation, which he was beaten up, tortured, to confess that he did throw stones, which resulted in a liver failure and spleen failure and all kind of health complications. He was still sentenced anyway for 1 year in prison, which he was released before the 1 year passed. He died a few days after in the hospital in Jerusalem. I was 10 years old then, trying to deal with this reality. And the idea of reconciliation and peace and forgiveness seems stupid to think even about at this moment. When somebody killed your brother, you really don't think of peace, and you don't think of forgiveness, and you don't think of any of these words. The only thing I thought about at that moment was being angry, being bitter, being really bitter at God, being bitter at people, at the Israeli soldiers, at all of that. My relationship with God totally became changed completely at that moment. And my family became more and more religious. I became more and more anti-religious at this moment. I still kept doing a lot of the stuff, but the relationship with God became very weak because I blamed God for all of this. But also, I decided that if somebody punched you in the face, what's the first thing you do? Be honest. What's the first thing you do? I know you want to say, well, you give him your other... What the first thing comes to your mind? You want to punch back, right? And that's exactly how I felt. I felt if somebody hurt me, then the first thing I want to do is to hurt back. What can I do? Now, I was 14. I decided to get into politics. I became an editor for a youth magazine. I joined a secular national movement in Palestine called Fatah. If you follow the news, you know about it a little bit. And I became very active, and I decided to become active in writing, because to me, writing was safe somewhat. Hopefully you don't get the same trouble for doing it. Still, you could go and spend a few years in prison for it. And I wrote every week 2, 3, 4 articles, which were kind of similar to the media you read today. Angry, divisive, we, they. And I thought, I'm revenging it through this way. I thought, this is the best way to get my revenge. I can get people angry. Well, through that, a lot of bad things still happened. So we were evacuated from our home, or forced to leave our home to move to a different place. I've seen 3 students in my class were killed. So a lot of crazy stuff were still happening, which only adds to your anger and only adds to your hatred and only makes you more and more justified for your cause. And there's always a good justification for many of the bad things we do. But also makes you think in the ethical question, which comes out a lot, is, well, maybe, yeah, there's the two sides of wrong, but we kind of more ethical than they are. Look, they killed my friends. We would never have done that. Well, sure enough, yeah, my people did as bad and worse sometimes. But there's the thing is, but we wouldn't get to the point that they would have got. I mean, they were really bad. And you start convincing yourself in that, and you're very sure that you are right and they are wrong. I lived in Jerusalem at that moment. Between East and West Jerusalem, there is no checkpoint. There is no separation. You can cross, unlike the West Bank, and I'll show you a couple pictures later. But in East Jerusalem, you really can meet. I've grown up in a neighborhood 200 meters from a Jewish neighborhood. Nothing stopping us from meeting. Never met. Never talked. Well, we did throw things at each other occasionally. But that was the most interaction we had. After I finished high school, however, I realized that if I don't learn Hebrew, because through high school it was mandatory to learn Hebrew, but I managed to go 3 years not learning a one word, and no, I will not tell you how I passed my exams. In case there are any students here, not going to give you any ideas. But I finished high school, realized that, wait, if I don't learn Hebrew, I can never go to work in Jerusalem. I can never go to college, to a good college. You have to have to know the language. So I realized the best place to learn Hebrew is a place called Ulpan, which is where Jewish newcomers go to learn Hebrew. Now, this was awkward. I didn't want to be there. I don't really want to meet anybody there, and I think I didn't like anybody there anyway. But since I cared about my future and my education and wanting to get a good job, I thought I'll push myself and do it. I was the only Palestinian in a classroom, mainly Jewish students. And in the beginning, I didn't want to talk to anyone. But you know what they do to you when you're learning a second language? They force you to talk to each other. So they set you up 2s and 3s and 4 people together, and they give you a list of questions, and they say, ask, how are you? Who are you? Where are you from? And so you go through asking all these questions, and something crazy happened to me, because as I start asking these questions, I kind of started liking these people. One, they weren't the same stereotype I had. I mean, it started with the smallest thing. I mean, we went out to we'll be asking questions, what kind of music you like. And I am the only Palestinian I know in the world who likes country music. When I tell my Palestinian friends about country music, they say, what is that? They don't have an idea. Now, I think if they know, they will change their mind. I hope. Now, I'm in Georgia. You got to be with me on that. Come on, right? I thought people here do like country music. But in that class, surprisingly, I found some Jews who do like country music. No, there weren't many, but some did. And to me, that was crazy. It's the smallest thing that's realizing, wait, we have some stuff in common. We kind of like each other. And we still disagreed over some things, like Israelis, they like a coffee called Nescafe, which is a horror. It's the instant coffee. It's the worst coffee to ever exist. And I've always told them I'm willing to cross the line so much for peace, but not that far. I like what you call here Turkish coffee. It's actually Arabic coffee. And it's good stuff. Thank you. Those who came with us on the tour last year to Jerusalem, I think we made sure you drank some of it, or we tried to make sure you did. Some liked it. Some thought, what's that muddy thing you forcing us to drink? But it was amazing to understand, to change really my reality at that moment, because at that time I started figuring out that there is a presupposition, there's preconceptions that you grew up having that a lot of times is a complete lie. And my facts were based on somewhat truth. Part truth. I mean, I've seen my brother being killed. I've seen my neighbors being killed, shot. I've seen my house being attacked. I've been shot at many times. I've been asked to return at the checkpoint and not go to my school. So it wasn't a made up history. But I knew a very little of the other side. I knew only a small picture of those who stand on the other side. And I didn't meet the people. I didn't meet the human being. And that class, it was very hard to keep that perception for me, because I got to cross the line. And the whole idea of being more ethical starts falling apart, because really none of us was more ethical than the other. We both were as bad. We both were doing evil things to each other. Yeah, there are some political things that would need to happen, but in that class I was able for the first time to have a conversation with people from the other side. Just a normal conversation, not with a soldier, not with somebody with a gun, because as nice as a soldier can be, you really cannot have a conversation with somebody with a gun. But to be able to sit and to talk. This is how my change started. Now, I'll talk about my conversion maybe more tomorrow, but amazingly, it was in the same class that I was invited to church as well. And that made the other change, the more important change in my life. But there I learned a few things in that class. One is how much media can change our perception. And we think sometimes when we become Christians that, oh, we completely changed. This is not true. A lot of things keep popping back up for you and trying to convince you of things. And things that you grew up believing that you haven't dealt with even when you became a Christian. There's all these packages and stuff, and the Bible says that. In Romans 8, it talks about how our sinful nature will keep coming up and it'll keep trying to convince us to believe in things. And nationalism is one of those things. Sinful nature wants us to believe that because I'm an American, I'm better than somebody else, or because I'm a Palestinian, I'm kind of more ethical, or because I'm Jewish, I'm kind of better, I'm chosen. You can always... These are not things of the Spirit. You know, I always say, because I'm a Palestinian, I never have had a citizenship. No Palestinian, no Israeli, no Jordanian, no nothing. I'm of no citizenship. Now I have an American green card because we moved here, so it's kind of cool. But it was great because people would ask me, so what are you? And I say, oh, I'm a Christian. No, what's your citizenship? Christian, really? I didn't... That's the only citizenship I really had anyway. But that's true for all of us. That is the only citizenship we do have. But a lot of times our wisdom from the past comes up. And I want to read in 1 Corinthians 1. I have some bullet points here of what I wanted to say. And I totally messed everything up, which is normal for what I do. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, in verse 20. Well, let's start in verse 18, actually. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. You know, when we become Christians, we decide that our wisdom is worthless. That we should not trust our own wisdom. But later on, a few weeks later, we kind of start thinking again sometimes, well, what about this? And what about that? And in Israel, Palestine, one of the first things will come back to you is you being Arab and you being Jewish. And you start trusting again a lot of times in our wisdom. Well, but there are situations where kind of the love your enemy thing just doesn't make sense. And we've had some of those conversations. I've had a lot of those conversations with Christians. It's just, how will it work? I mean, they want to kill me. What do you mean love them? Okay, I love them, but I need to kill them too, right? I mean, somebody trying to kill you. What do you mean by love them and pray for them? What kind of wisdom is that? And you start doubting really God's wisdom when it says, be a peacemaker. You start doubting God's wisdom when he says, pray for those who persecute you. You start doubting God's wisdom when Jesus went to the cross not fighting those who are trying to kill him, really. And it's a rough thing when you're living into it. But this kind of wisdom, we try to get back to our own. And I like to put it in a story, a funny story. Trying to keep the light and heaviness together, learning from Doug. When I was young, I was 10 years old. My dad decided, he did that often. He'll buy animals and let me take care of them. A lot of parents do that. They'll do something and then ask the children, they punish us through it, you know. So he decided to buy some sheep. And, you know, he got those 5 sheep and said, oh, Aziz, from now on, instead of going playing soccer after school, you're going to take care of those sheep, which I was very excited about. So the first few days, I'll take out those sheep, and I take them. We had a nice big land, which had a lot of grass, and the grass is the best food for the sheep. It's the best food as well when you eat them. It's really good for, makes them eat good. They didn't know that, and we didn't tell them, but it's the best food for them. But sheep, you know, the Bible says we are like sheep, and this is where I got offended kind of with that statement, because the sheep were the stupidest thing to ever exist. I take them to the area full of grass, the nicest food area you can imagine, but they didn't want to eat the grass. Can you guess what they wanted to eat? Plastic bags. Plastic bags was their favorite food. They enjoyed plastic bags. The only problem with plastic bags, they'll suffocate and die. And if that happens, I was going to follow them because my dad would not let me live after. So I had to keep watching them. And every time they eat the plastic bag, open their mouth, and they thinking I'm torturing them while I was saving their life. But, you know, that is our wisdom. And when we stick to our ideas of prejudice and racism, we are sticking to the plastic bags that God is saying, no, don't eat that. This is what the world believes. This is not what we believe as Christians. God's wisdom is about changing our perception from that area. You know, I want to show you how, you know, this is some crazy pictures, but I want to show you what the world sells us, at least in Jerusalem, and I'm sure it sells you that. These are Palestinian kids carrying rockets. If you're an Israeli and you watch that, guess what that makes you think? Yeah, we should kill them all because even their kids, look at them. Let's go to the next one. This is Israeli kids writing with love on rockets that were bombed to Lebanon. And guess what Palestinian... These were only in Palestinian newspapers. The others were only in Israeli newspapers. Yeah, so guess what people who saw that thought? Israelis, they all hate us. Jews, they all want to kill us, even their children. So it's okay to kill their children. Let's move on. This is just to for you to understand. This is the map and how things have changed from before 48, the second one 48, 67. The white is Israeli, the green is Palestinian, and that's where we are now. Just so you'd want to know the area we're talking about. Let's move. The next. This is Palestinian town and a settlement. Look how close they are. And I tell you, none of these people ever meet. They throw rocks at each other and they shoot at each other. There's no meetings. And people don't stand each other in both of these areas. This is what's called the separation wall. It's between the West Bank, the Palestinian areas, and Israel. Now, we have disciples on both sides of this wall. And I'll talk about that later. This is a 600 kilometers long wall, about 20 some feet high, and that basically separates the two communities. Let me remember if there's next one. This is one of the terror attacks in Jerusalem, and this is a bus. Actually, you know, when you think of terror attacks, you think Arabs attacking Jews. However, I used to take this line, the bus, every morning. So I could have been in this bus being a Palestinian. It didn't really, to me, I was kind of in the two sides. If the Palestinians attack, I could get hurt. If the Israelis attack, I could get hurt, which was not the best place to be. And this is a picture of the church in Jerusalem. You see some Arabs, Jews, and even some Americans. We let them in. But these are the things that influence us. And as I go and speak a lot in the States, not just to churches, to synagogues, to all kind of groups, to schools, and about Israel-Palestine. And there is the amount of ignorance and racism is amazing. Because people got a very set up perception. Now, normally in America, they like Israel more. And normally in Europe, they like the Palestinians more. And normally I tell them, thank you, you are hurting us as Palestinians and Israelis, because when you support one against the other, you're just helping us killing each other, which I don't appreciate. Regardless if you're pro-Palestinian or if you're pro-Israel, it's not helping either. And I've been blessed to be able to go and talk about that to both Jews and Palestinians and Americans here in the last really 10 years. So how do we deal with these when we come to church? How do you deal with the pictures, the media, all these crazy things that comes to our life? First, it's really not a one-time thing. There's no, oh, I decided to change and that's it. From now on, I'll never deal with prejudice and racism in my life ever again. If you really believe that, you're joking with, you know, you're fooling yourself. It's a long fight, and it's a daily fight a lot of times. I became a Christian in 99, and since then I had to struggle through it all, literally every day I have to go through a checkpoint. I had to struggle through my attitude. Every day I watched the news, I had to struggle through my attitude. Every day I talked to my friends, I had to struggle through my attitude. And the church had to deal with that too in Jerusalem. Because it wasn't just a personal thing. I mean, we had Christians in Bethlehem who weren't allowed to come to Jerusalem. They can't cross to Jerusalem. It's only 10 miles. We had Christians who couldn't leave their homes for 6 months because of curfew. They can't leave at all. You're out of your house, you're shot, you're dead. It would be naive for us to think that will not affect their perceptions. We had Israeli brothers and sisters too. We had some who lost friends in those bombings. It affects and what they go through. We had a brother, he worked as a guard. And he always was open to being basically attacked. And he had to be always careful and worried. And that added to the anxiety. We had a brother who was asked to serve in the army, in the Israeli army. And he was told he was going to be put at a checkpoint. The only problem with that for him was his brothers were going to be at those checkpoints trying to pass to come to church, and he has to tell them no. How do you deal with that? That brother decided to not go to the army and go to prison, because in Israel it's mandatory. You have to go to the army. It was a personal decision he did. The Palestinian disciples came and told him, we understand you have to do it. And we won't be upset if you do it. And he thought, no, I can't. I will not be able to stand at checkpoint and tell you can't pass. If I do, if I let you pass, I'll be breaking the law, and I won't do that. So the only way is to tell them I won't do it, which sent him to prison for 14 days. One thing we had to do in Jerusalem was to open up and talk about it, to tackle the problem, to be willing to say, we understand prejudice exists. We understand we struggle with it too. And we're not going to just brush it off and say it's not there. We sat, not one day, not two. We did a workshop for 6 months, weekly. We had meetings every week talking about what our biblical perception should be. Now, in Jerusalem, even we were a small group, we had people to the extreme right and people to the extreme left. And let me tell you, in Palestine, Israel, everybody loves politics. Politics is the drive of that place. I mean, we enjoy arguing too. You think Americans are opinionated. Try some Middle Easterns. I mean, the joke is you have two Jews or two Arabs, doesn't matter. You get three opinions. And of my experience, it is completely true. We like to argue. We have so many opinions. And even our church meetings, sometimes we can be very strongly opinionated. But it's good. That's why we needed 6 months. It couldn't be done in 2 weeks or one workshop. But we had to basically struggle through these feelings and through these opinions. And what do you think about the settlement? How do we deal with that? And we said, we're not going to go against political views. We're going to go against things that are not biblical. If politicians promote it, that's their problem. But we're going to only tackle issues, not politics. You can still vote for whoever you want, but let's make sure our hearts are clean. And that the perceptions we have are right. And we correct those perceptions and we understand where each one is coming from. For me to be able to be open, say, here's where I come from. Here's what really bothers me. Here's what hurts me. And for them to say, for the Israeli brothers and sisters, say, here's what we came from. And here is what hurts us. To be able to create that kind of place, a safe place for dialogue. And we were blessed because we had a sister who interned with the church in Jerusalem, and she was a social worker. She had her master's in social work, and she helped us go through it as well, and she provided all the counseling we kind of needed as we went through. But it was amazing to see the church transform. And this was a light to nations, because let me tell you about Jerusalem. Almost, there's no church, almost, because there might be, but I haven't really came across churches that are Palestinians and Jews worshiping together. When we invite people to church there and we tell them we are Palestinians and Jews together, if they Jews, they say, why would you worship with those Gentiles? That's a very common, if they Christian Jews, that's what they would say. Why would you go to a church where the leader is a Palestinian? I mean, are you out of your mind? That's a common answer. If you invite a Palestinian, he'll say, you are a Zionist group, you're anti-Palestinian, you have Jews in your church. And that's normal. Churches are strongly divided. They are so strongly divided and politically divided also that, for example, when the war in Lebanon was going on in 2006, some churches, some of the biggest churches there, the Israeli churches, the Jewish churches, they posted some of them prayers that they had. They posted them on their website that included stuff like, God, we pray that you crush the enemy, Lebanon, completely. And you read that and you think, where can you get that in the New Testament? Where do you see Jesus praying these prayers? What about praying for your enemies? Well, they used scriptures from Psalms where David prayed, and they said, well, it applies, and this is biblical, and we stand by our people. But there is no our people. Well, with the Palestinians, they were more identifying, again, with the Lebanese. And even, again, with the church we had. When I went to Bethlehem, they'll be like, have you been watching these pictures? It's heartbroken. How can you watch these pictures and not be angry? And then went to Jerusalem, they're like, oh, the people in the north, the Jews in the north are being evacuated because of the bombing. And we're going to open our houses to them, which was great. But there was still this kind of raft that we had to work on. But to be able still with all of this to come together and worship together was a light to all nations. And we paid that little price for that, that our church didn't grow as fast as we wanted it to. And I had many friends who would tell me, only if you separate the services, still be the same church, just separate them. Just don't have Arabs and Jews worship together. We promise you, your church is good. It'll grow so fast. But just don't have that Arab-Jewish thing in your church. It's just not popular. Yeah, probably the church would grow a lot faster if we separated them. I tell you, even actually, unfortunately, even within our church, some people told me that. But yeah, the church will grow faster. But it's not going to be a real church. If we are afraid to say our Jewish brothers and sisters are our brothers and sisters and we love them and we'll worship together with them as long as it's possible, then it's not a real church. And we went through everything possible to make sure this worship happens together. The only place, because of the wall we watched earlier, the only place we can worship together in the West Bank, there's only one place. It's in Talita Kumi. It's a Lutheran church that went to court basically against the wall because they are a church and they said, you can't separate us from our both communities. And the case is taking years, fortunately. And I knew them through my peace work very good. And I asked them, can we rent your church to do our services? Because in that place, the Palestinians come from the Palestinian side, the Israelis come from the Israeli side, and we meet in the middle. And we have a room and we can worship together. It's the only place you can do that. And we were blessed enough to have that place open for us every week. And be able to come and sing in Arabic and Hebrew and Russian. Now I got to warn you, I was singing really bad because you got two people who know how to sing any song. And often are not musically talented like me. But it's still great. Even when we're not musically talented, we're still able to do that. We still can sing. You know, this, though, doesn't end there. And it speaks to people here. The whole Arab-Jewish and the whole conflict. And, you know, when Marie, my wife, is from Idaho, people think, how did you meet her from Idaho? She came to Jerusalem in a mission trip, and a few days later I kind of convinced her to switch her school to Jerusalem, giving her an advice as the minister said, telling her how important it is for the church to, you know, we need missionaries and we really would appreciate her moving and helping with the church. Also, for me, it was a good thing. And she went home and we started dating. She went home and told some of her friends. She called some friends and disciples and told them, yeah, I'm moving to Jerusalem and I'm starting to date a brother there. He leads a church there. He's a Palestinian. And one of the disciples told her, be aware of them. He's Palestinian. He might be a terrorist. That's reality. It exists even sometimes within our churches. When we had that intern coming from Boston, the disciple, the social worker, she was calling some of her friends and one of them said, why would you go to there? Why didn't you go on a mission team in America? Why would you want to go to Israel and Palestine? Crazy people. Well, he kind of right about the crazy people, but these things exist, and if we don't tackle them, they grow. I mean, there's a lot of theology that's growing on in America, especially some interesting stuff about where the important thing is not really reaching out to people. The important thing is supporting the Jewish people. And I'll tell you what, this is growing faster than you think. It's the fastest growing theology probably in America. It's all about, last 2 years ago, one of the famous televangelists came to Jerusalem, donated $6 million. To church? No. To the Israeli army. $6 million to the army? That's what's important? Well, he said, he justified it. He said, because that's what matters, is Israel winning the war. It's not souls. It's not people. It's not relationships. It's not the churches there. What matters was more that Israel wins the war. Well, that's not the stand we take. And if we don't target it, some people in our churches will start developing these ideas. And some people will start thinking, well, I mean, if you watch the news here, I watch the news, I start being afraid of my own family, I guess, there. I mean, it sounds like they're very scary. And if we don't tackle these issues, we'll really get into it. I want to read in James 3. James 3, verse 18. 13 to 18. I'm sorry. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, and of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness. Now it talks about being a peacemaker. And we as a church, I think, are called to be peacemakers. We are called to do that in our life. You know, in addition to my work with the church, I did that in the first many years as a volunteer, then I took it eventually as a job. But in the first few years after I converted, I decided to become active in what we call the peace movement in Palestine, Israel. And I joined a group called the Bereaved Families Forum, a radical group. It's one of the biggest organizations, and I ended up being the chairman for that organization. And it's a 500 families of Israelis and Palestinians who all lost a family member in the conflict and all working for peace. We occasionally come in the media here. We had a couple documentaries. You might have heard or seen anything about it. But it was a great work to be able to come and say, look at this example. But as I've been doing this over and over, one question that comes up to me, and it comes up even from Christians, is, and it comes in different degrees. Some people would ask me about how do I see that fitting with my work as an evangelist when I was there, and does it take off my time a lot? And eventually I actually worked there part-time, and it financed me working for the church without getting paid by the church, which was great. But also, what peace is really when people become Christians. So is it worth it that you do what you're doing in the peace movement? And it's a very, very good question, very interesting question. And my answer is, well, let me break it down to a few things. One, here it says, we are to become peacemakers. Also, it talks about us doing things in our life. Our wisdom is about actions in our life that people will watch and say, he's different. What I've been able to do in my work in the peace movement is push for the Christian theology, push for the Christian really way of conflict resolution and reconciliation into our conflict and into the way we're dealing with it. And if you think of all the big conflicts that have been solved in the world, Ireland, South Africa, how were they solved? When were they solved? The civil rights, even here. Wasn't Christian principles that helped ending the killing in these countries? South Africa was all about reconciliation. Where did the word reconciliation come from? Where did the whole principle come from? It's a Christian principle. And by being able to work in the peace movement and say, here's a Christian principle, if you apply this, it will work. And you will see a change is incredible. And it's a great opportunity to be able to bring and watch people who are enemies and hate each other come, and I'll sit with groups and be able to, those who would want to, literally, I've been in meetings where people did tell me, I'm waiting to go to the army so I can kill as many Palestinians as possible. I've met people who are 17, 18 year old who told me that in a school meeting in Israel. And I had an hour and a half conversation with him. And by the end of the meeting, he said, you confuse me. I don't know what to do. To be able to do that is worth doing it. Because I tell you what, without him getting to that point, I don't know how he anyway had a chance of becoming a Christian. Without me changing my perception about Jews in that class I had, I probably would not have come to church, because the church, the preacher was Jewish when I came to Jerusalem church. I would have not wanted to talk to this guy. I would have walked out a minute after I came in. But since I already have made Jewish friends, I was, okay, I'll check out what's this about. It fit very well. But also, you think of all the other things we do that is not necessarily about conversion. James 1, 27, what does it say? Religion is about, pure religion is about what? Taking care of who? Orphans? Widows. We take care of who also? In Psalms 82, 3, it says, defend the cause of the weak and fatherless, maintain the right of the poor and the oppressed. Well, we've done a very good job helping the poor as a church, I must say. But I believe a lot of times we kind of ignore the rest because it's more touchy. Giving money to help the poor is easier than getting ourselves into this whole oppression and people and peace and helping people who are enemies. It kind of can get into offending people too much. Well, but it's in the Bible. Helping people, bringing people together is something very biblical. You know, one of my favorite scriptures, and this we studied in Jerusalem, Isaiah 58. And let's read it, actually. Isaiah 58, verse 6. Isaiah 58, 6. Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke? To set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer and with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe him and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood? You know, you can keep going on. It really ties a lot of times the poor, the oppressed, the conflict areas. I mean, wherever there's conflict, there's oppressed people. And one thing is we read this scripture in Jerusalem and said, who are the oppressed here? Or there are not only one group who are oppressed. If you are Russian in Israel, a lot of times, even though you're Jewish, you immigrant, you have citizenship, a lot of times you're oppressed. If you're an Ethiopian in Israel, you are badly oppressed. Because, well, you're not allowed in certain schools. You're not allowed in certain neighborhoods. It's hard to believe, but it's reality. If you're Palestinian, a lot of times you are oppressed. But even within the Palestinian community, there are certain people who are oppressed. And we said, we're going to identify people who are oppressed and see what we can do to help. What we can do to support these oppressed within our own community. We're not taking a political stance. We're not interested in politics as a church. Personally, each one can do that. It's your choice. I decided to get more involved in politics. Other people in the church decided not to. And if I do, it's outside my work in the church. I had the opportunity to meet, which I thought was good, to meet leaders and to meet presidents and all of that and to tell them what I think. I thought it's worth doing it. Other disciples thought, that's not my place. You do it. But we all call to really do that. We all call to love our neighbors. And when Jesus was asked about who's the neighbor, he gave the story of the Samaritan. Now, Samaritans were hated a lot from the Jews. I mean, if you compare Palestinians and Jews now, and you think Jews don't like Palestinians, oh, not even close to how much they didn't like the Samaritans. They were, with the Romans, they considered the Romans much nicer. Well, we'll live with the Romans, but not those Samaritans. They kind of not really even human. The Romans at least built an empire. You can respect them for that. The Samaritans, oh. Well, when Jesus went through it, it's amazing because he didn't make... Who's the hero of the story of the Good Samaritan? He didn't make it that the Jew will help the Samaritan. He made it the opposite. He made it that the Samaritan is helping the Jew. Making him the hero. Bringing him up. See, a lot of times I hear people saying, but Jesus didn't take a stand with these things. No, Jesus did take a stand. When he saw people need help, when he saw a conflict, he did take a stand. And he told people racism is not accepted. He was clear about that. We read about Jonah yesterday. I mean, God took a very clear stand against prejudice. He's not okay with us saying, oh, it's not my conflict. I don't need to worry about it. The Bible tells us to pray for peace, to pray for our leaders. What else? It's really when the Bible tells you to pray about anything, he also is telling you to act, not just to pray. It's not, oh God, just help bring peace, all that. I don't need to worry about it. People will watch how we live. Let me tell you the perception about Christians in Palestine. They love war, they're aggressive, and they have no morals. I'm sorry to say it, but why? Well, the only news we see, unfortunately, is about Christians demonstrating asking for wars. Now, I understand this doesn't represent Christianity, but that's what people see. What do we do? When I go and reach to people and try to study the Bible with them, these are the questions they ask me. And if we're not aggressive in showing, no, we are peacemakers. We don't hate anybody. We're willing to extend a hand to everybody. We have no prejudice against Muslims, Jews, Hindus, regardless who they are. We care about everyone because only then we're really able to reach out to them. Otherwise, it's all about theology. And let me tell you, you don't convert people with theology. You convert them by showing them how it works in your own life. People respect you, and you don't just come and tell them, oh, I believe in peace, and yeah, all people should get along, but see you actually doing it. If you say that, and you know, if you're white and don't have any black friends, and there's areas full of black people, right. Sure, I believe you. And when Marie and I got married, we got married in Bethlehem, it was illegal for Israelis to cross the border. It was 1 week after an Israeli soldier was kidnapped. Nobody would have trusted to come to a Palestinian town. Had 50 Jewish Israelis coming to our wedding, all breaking the law, all putting their life really at risk in the sense they could go to prison, in the sense people could, you know, they're in Palestinian town with no protection, though that's kind of not true because my family is huge and my family vowed to protect anybody who would come to the wedding. They actually provided bodyguards and all of that was crazy. But 50 Israeli Jews coming to the West Bank, breaking their own law, saying, we're going to be here. Half of those were Christians. The other half were friends I made through my work that said, we're going to come to your wedding regardless what, because we care about you and we'll come. And it was amazing to see that. But that's practice, not theology. You know, we had a group once, and I have 5 minutes, I can still talk. We had a group once that came, a group of Christians, and I brought a rabbi. He was a chief army rabbi in Israel to speak to them. And it was very convicting because he said, you Christians talk a lot about faith. You keep saying, yeah, we believe this, and we believe that, and we believe this, and we believe that. And he said, we Jews believe into practice. So if you put your faith into action, we can talk. But you always talk, and argue over faith things instead of argue about what to do. And it was very convicting to the group who was there. I mean, all of us were like, okay. But he's right. The Bible says that. James says that. Without actions, our faith is dead. Without showing it out there, without doing something about what we believe, without reaching out to the people that are around us, we can't claim to be doing it. And it makes a huge difference. It makes a huge difference when people see it. It makes a huge difference in our life. It keeps our hearts pure. It keeps us battle with this instead of put it on the shelf. You know, when we don't want to deal with it, we just put it on the shelf, say, yeah, I love everyone. I believe in peace. I'll pray about it. But if it's right there, you deal with it every day. Oh, you have to deal with your feelings. You have to deal with your heart. You have to be open about it. I mean, it is something we have to confess. Prejudice, racism, it's just like every other sin. When did you confess last time prejudice? It's something kind of we don't think about as much. It's okay. We have to identify our prejudice and be open when it happens. And go to somebody and say, you know what? This happened. I've sinned. I'm blessed because my wife recognizes it before I confess it. And I say some stupid things often. If you know me, you really know how often I do. But sometimes our prejudice can be even against our own people. I mean, when Gaza elections happened in 2006 and Hamas won, and I get so mad. And I made the worst comments. Yeah, they're stupid. They can't believe they did that. How could they vote for them? And they'll see what's going to happen and kind of predicted more or less what's going to happen. They'll get bombed and they deserved it. That lasted as long as when they get bombed and then you regret every word you said. You regret really knowing it. But my wife at that moment said, "You are being sinful. How can you think that? Yes, I don't like Hamas as an organization, but they are people just like you. And they are sinful just like you. And you need to love them like everybody else." And I started trying. I can be very prideful. And I started justifying my comments. But she was right. We can be even prejudiced against our own people. We can be prejudiced against our own. We can say a lot of things, and it's good when somebody can point it out. It's good when you open about it and you're able to go and say, "I need to repent." If we don't look at prejudice, at racism, at sexism, at classism, as sin, just sin, we won't be able to change it. And as important of a sin, as damaging of a sin as every other sin, we won't be able to change it. And if we don't talk about it enough in our churches, it won't change. It's something hard, it's something rough, I understand, but it's something, if we deal with it, completely changes our lives. It completely changes everything around you. And it'll give you ability to reach people you never thought you'd reach. And it'll give you opportunity to share your faith with people you never thought you'd share. And build new friendships that will change your life that you never thought you can build. My best friend in Israel is a Russian Israeli Jew, a Christian, who's on the completely opposite side of me politically. And we talk about it a lot. But he's a person who saved me from so many problems and things. And he's a person I know, with all our differences, would put his life for me. He would lay his life for me, and I know it. And I would do the same for him, because it's not about him being Israeli and me being a Palestinian. We are, first of all, brothers. Thank you.
You want to take some questions? Well, why don't you come on up to the front? But this isn't going to be so long, because otherwise we're cutting into Joey Harris's period. I'll just say this. The lunch is 12 to 1:30. Please be back at 1:15. Please be back early so we can start right on time. And by the clock on the wall, we've got 10 minutes for questions.
Thank you.
All right. Back by popular demand.
Yeah, 1:15, we'll try to do that. You know, the Arab culture is, you, if you're not late an hour, you're not, you know, it's just wrong.
Should I just stand here? Would that be safe? The safest?
Go ahead. Yeah, I mean, there's not a one exact way, but first it really starts with you learning about Islam. You cannot reach out to somebody if you don't understand their religion. Reading the Quran would be a good start. Reading the book would be a good start. But if you don't understand what they believe, you can't. The moment you do, Muslims often like to talk about religion. In my experience, I enjoyed arguing. As I said earlier, we like to argue. So the moment you know and you show them that you know and you start opening a conversation, it really roll in easily. But one mistake a lot of Christians do is right away start with telling them how Islam is crazy religion and Muhammad did 1, 2, 3 and I can't believe you even believe in this. Yeah, you won't convert them. It's just, and I've seen it happening. I've seen it happening with missionaries too, who have not been successful in reaching out to Muslims in Muslim countries. So the way is really to start with things I believe that first we agree on, and show them that you understand what they believe in, you respect them as you're talking to them, and from there you can ask, if you ask questions and then start show them scriptures, it'll be good. One of the things they did with me is as I start reading, well, they knew first a lot about Islam, but they also encouraged me to read the Bible. And one of the things I do, I tell the Muslims I meet is, look, I've read the Quran. Now, sometimes they don't know my background, so they don't understand that I knew it since I was a little kid. But the moment I said I read the Quran, I said, why about you reading the Bible and we can have some talking about it? And I recommend normally John as a good book to read. And as they start reading, they start learning about Jesus. And that's really where you want to get them to. Instead of get it all about Islam being right or wrong, eventually you want to take them to look at what is Christianity. Look at who's Jesus and look at the difference. Okay. We had a sister who from Boston, she's now in Boston, who helped me putting it together. And so we had topics, I don't think the way we did it wouldn't work in a large setting. It was very small setting, was very targeted. But we had very planned program through it. And we targeted racism, we targeted nationality, we targeted specific issues to the Palestinian-Israeli, we targeted messianic churches and their beliefs because they were getting into our church, the whole thing of the Jews own the land but the Arabs shouldn't be here, is that biblical or not? We had to answer those questions for us as a church because it meant a lot to me as a Palestinian. If my Jewish brother think I should be kicked out of the country, it's kind of problem. So we had to go into the Bible to look at these answers. Yes. Well, it takes to be willing to really listen and learn and not judge. If you judge everything with an American standard, then you're going to look at the Arab culture, the Israeli culture as below your culture. But if you look at it, it's just different cultures. You can learn actually from it, then it's completely different. It comes really with what perception you approach it. We have very different cultures, some of it better, some of it worse, in the sense of certain activities. Maybe that's what it would be viewed. But really, it's just every culture has its good and has its bad. And if you come with a superiority mentality to any other culture, you won't be able to reach them. They'll see you as thinking that you're better. One of the things that help when people go there or you're reaching to somebody from other culture, ask a lot of questions and learn. Spend time to say, I want to learn about more about this, this, this. And it's amazing. You'll learn some great stuff about, one of the things always fascinates people about the Arab tribal culture and the system of justice system. My dad is an elder for my family, and my family is huge. My tribe is about 60,000 people. And we actually have very similar thing to the church. We have elders to each small group of few hundreds, and when there's problems, these people meet and fix the problems. Some people look at it as backward and not obeying the law and blah, 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 all of that. And the other hand, it has a lot of things that's really positive, and it's able to fix many problems in the society that the law is not able to force, just like in church. Yes, I'll come back. How can I justify loving our country? I think it's normal when you live in a place, you're grateful for it, you love it, you pray for the peace of it. The Christians in the first century always prayed for their country to live in peace. It's about, does this love becomes more important than your really than God and then being a citizen in God's kingdom? That's more important. Yeah, you love your country, you love the people in your country, you want peace for your country, but that's not important, not more important than God. And the moment we make country more important, nationalism more important, the moment we really change the whole perspective on it, and it's idolatry in many ways. That's a long story. I went it through, it's a process. So if I went to my parents and told them, hey, I converted to Christianity, I would have been dead 10 years ago. Because it just wasn't, I was 18 years old, and to them, it would have been, as I said, my dad's an elder for my family, and this is a shame and honor community in many ways, and this will shame him, and wouldn't know how to deal with it. So there would have been a big possibility of dying. I was threatened to be killed for it from my own family. But my family is, I'm very blessed because they found a way kind of to deal with it. I did sit with them. I did read the Bible with them. I did a lot of things. I always tried to avoid the confrontation. But eventually it came to the point where people would come to my parents and say, we've seen your son inviting people on the street to church. Or your son, you know, they'll come with all these things. And my parents decided to say, okay, we know, but we have to protect him, when they realized I wasn't going to change. So their answer was, oh, it's just, it's not true, or they'll come up with ideas, until I get married, and it became very easy. So they tell people, oh, his wife is a Christian, he just goes with her. They're like, no, but he was at church. Yeah, he's just, he wouldn't let his wife go to church alone. And they're like, yeah, but he was preaching. And that's my favorite answer, because what they say, well, if he's there, let him speak. Now, I am really blessed, because that's what, not what most Muslim families would do. Right. And my family decided to protect me. My brother came to me and said, there are people going to print a paper against you in Bethlehem, spread it around, which basically would be a death sentence if that happened. He said, fortunately, I was able to stop it, but slow down your work. And I'm really blessed for that, because, again, I managed for 10 years to do what I did there, and as open as you can imagine, and still never got hurt. And I think it's God, but my family being a great support in the behind the scene. I got to read the Bible with some members of my family. A couple of my brothers came to church a few times. It's very slow, but it's happening.
Brilliant. Thank you. Proud of your work. We're honored to know you. And thank you so much.